this is the fundamental thing that impacted us, me as a mediator, that people actually had better answers to their lives than anybody from the outside ever could.
The Center for Understanding and Conflict welcomes you to The Other Chair, a show that explores the dynamics of conflict. Why do we double down in our position? Together with our guests, we explore how the power of understanding one another can lead to better solutions. We will also share tips for managing your own mediation practice.
Hi, I'm Phuong Ertley, and I'm a psychotherapist. I help families and couples understand, address, and heal relationship difficulties. That's why I'm excited to be here with Jennifer Sullivan on The Other Chair.
I'm Jennifer Sullivan, and I'm a lawyer who wears a few different hats professionally. What really excites me is understanding how conflicts arise and how to help people navigate their way out of them. That's what Phuong Ertley and I will be talking about on The Other Chair podcast.
Hi, this is Phuong Ertley, co-host of The Other Chair. In our very first episode, we will discover the origin story of the mediation practice. What happens when you turn your back on your family, tradition, and even the practice of law itself? Follow Gary Friedman, the founder of this model, and his journey from his New England law firm to California in the 1970s. California at that time was deep in the throes of the revolutionary peace and love movement, as well as the humanistic educational psychology movement. As with any hero's journey, Gary's path was fraught with tears, tumult, and even the influences of a cult. In this episode, we explore how the idea of unconditional positive regard and the profound belief that people held the keys to their own lives changed Gary's personal life, as well as helped him forge the very foundations that would become the understanding in conflict model.
So Gary, thank you so much for being with us today at The Other Chair. And it's based on the understanding and conflict model. And for our listeners, could you please just succinctly explain what that model is and why it's so important and why we have a whole organization built around it?
Yeah, thanks. Well, first, I'm just really glad to be doing this. This is really kind of wonderful as I'm getting to be older. It's wonderful to feel like there are things that I can kind of look back on and understand from a different perspective. And so understanding, we picked that word as the most central word, and we call it the understanding model. The reason we did that is we thought that that was, although that doesn't describe everything about the model, it certainly captures the most significant and profound part of what we think can be the most useful tool in helping people resolve conflict. And so understanding and just seemed like, of all the different pieces of it, if everything else went by the boards, if we had understanding, that could really help, and that could actually create kind of fundamental change and help people when they're disagreeing with each other. So the understanding, of course, is a different, has a peculiar kind of power that's different than the ordinary power that people think that they have or they want to have when they're in conflict. Because what comes naturally to people is using the power of coercion, using the power of pressure, using the power of threat, whatever it is that we can do to try to force other people to change. And of course, what we understand is from that, that often escalates disputes or leaves people stuck. Understanding has a whole other kind of potential, which is if we can really understand, even when we disagree, it's possible that that expands, understand something new, that expands the possibilities for creating a foundation for resolving a dispute. So understanding is, and there are really three kinds of understanding that we think of. The first is understanding, if you're going to resolve a dispute, understanding the other person is really quite useful, because if you're going to have a consensual outcome, it's really quite useful and actually essential to understand their perspective. The second, and this might sound a little funny, is understanding yourself. People would just kind of naturally say, well, of course I understand myself. But that's not the way it is with conflict. With conflict, what happens is we're often just kind of thrown into it, and we find ourselves reacting to others. And we really haven't thought through, what is it that we really care about underlying this dispute? What's really important to us? What's really at the core of all this? And so understanding more deeply what we care about underlying the dispute is the second prong. And then the third prong is the external realities. It's not just you and me. It's whatever else needs to be taken into account. If we can find a way to expand our understanding of that, that will also be helpful. So those three prongs sit there as resources for us to actually be able to find a basis to resolve a dispute.
So the context in which you're talking about resolving disputes, Gary, are you talking about a courtroom? Or are you talking about something happening between parents that want separation? Are you talking about between neighbors? What's the context of that you're picturing this?
Everything. There's no dispute that I can imagine that people could have, if they were interested in it, where understanding wouldn't be helpful to them and at least help them take a step toward resolving the dispute. So it's the same whether it's countries warring with each other, families within families, neighbors, legal disputes, commercial disputes, just about everything that where there are differences between the sides, and the understanding is a kind of bridge that could actually help them. Whatever, in even large groups, small groups, individuals. It actually even disputes within inside ourselves. we often have different reactions internally to people, and so we feel conflicted sometimes inside. And so, really, actually understanding our internal conflicts also can be quite useful.
Gary, I wonder if we could take you back a bit. For people who are listening who might not know the history of not just the Center for Understanding and Conflict, but kind of going back to the roots of the beginnings of mediation, which you were a part of, could you talk a little bit about how you found your way to it, to this concept of helping parties resolve disputes?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether I should give you the 5-minute version or the 5-hour version.
Somewhere in between.
Right. So you'll stop me at various points saying, enough. So because it really does go back, it goes back to my childhood. And I don't think we want to go there around all this. But I think probably the fair place to start is my experience as a trial lawyer. And my experience as a trial lawyer was, I was kind of bred to be a trial lawyer, and in my family, and my father and my uncle, I was in their firm, and the defining story of our of my childhood was the case of Joseph Spell, and Joseph Spell was a black man who was a chauffeur who was arrested and charged with raping his boss, who's a Greenwich white woman. And my father and uncle, through the Civil Liberty ACLU, volunteered to represent him because nobody else would. And turns out that the ACLU sent their guy to sit in with them, and that was Thurgood Marshall. And so with an all-white jury, this Joseph Spell was found not guilty. And of course, it made my whole father and uncle's career. And there's a movie that's been made out of it now, and it's called Marshall. And so that was the story we grew up with.
So, Gary, what can you take us to the time and place? Where you, were you? What year was this? Because this is very significant.
Yeah, 1941 is when the trial was. So there it was during the war, a few years before I was born.
And well before the civil rights movement.
Yes, right. Oh, yes. And in Connecticut. It was, you know, there were, I don't think even in the juror pool, there were any people of color. They had no choice but to have an all white jury. And the forelady was a white woman from Virginia. So it was shocking, and it made national news, to have this guy, because they had to prove essentially she was lying. That was it. That was my idea of being a lawyer. You fight for the underdog. You have people that are wrongly accused, and justice comes. And that's what I had as my kind of idea of, this is what lawyers do. This is how every case would be. And of course, the reality was, when I started to practice law, it wasn't quite like that. And as a matter of fact, I felt there were a lot of things about being a trial lawyer that just didn't feel right to me in terms of my own inclinations and my own understanding of disputes, because especially when I was on one side and kind of hired to poke holes in what was wrong with what the other side was saying and to kind of act as if my side was entirely right, that was extremely, it just didn't fit the situations. And so I had to kind of change myself in terms of my attitude and become very aggressive. And I was. I got really good at being aggressive. But it didn't feel true. And I would often feel at the end of a case that everybody was kind of unhappy. And I was unhappy that even when I won, it was a very short-lived feeling. To feel like, oh, gee, we were vindicated. And the power that I had to cross-examine just seemed, I was kind of stunned by that, that you could actually make somebody who was apparently telling the truth appear to be not telling the truth or not getting it right. So this ate at me. It actually impacted how I was, not just actually as a lawyer, but even at home. And with friends, and the parts of my personality, and there were plenty of them, that loved aggression and fighting and winning and very competitive, got kind of exaggerated by my work as a trial lawyer. And I didn't like what was happening to me. So I stopped, actually just at the moment when my father and uncle had decided that I would become managing partner of the firm. Because I realized that if I did that, I was going to be there for life.
So you realized that you were at kind of a point at which it was going to be, you were going to fully commit to this, or you were going to do something entirely different?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't as if I didn't feel fully committed to it already. But as the growing discomfort, as I was dealing with that, when this was kind of a seminal moment, you're going to now be running this firm, and there were all the other lawyers were much older than I was, and I just felt like, oh, this is the moment. You've got to make some kind of decision. So I decided to quit, which was extremely a heavy blow to my father particularly.
So, Gary, is it okay if I kind of distill what you just said
please
for a moment so I can understand?
Yes, this is, you're practicing the understanding model.
That, well, the story of Joseph Spellman, is that his
Spell
Joseph Spell galvanized you or inspired you to fight for the underdog. It just seemed like it really moved you in a certain way to dedicate your life towards this sort of mission. And it seems like as you realized your ambitions to fight for the underdog, it seemed like over time you didn't like the act of fighting itself. The means in which you achieved your goal was fighting, and that didn't sit well with you.
I mean, in some ways, I liked it too much, the fighting. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it was like once in and doing it, I was good at it, I was in it. It was only when I would kind of step back that I would say, is this really how you think that this is, you're making the world a better place? How is this actually making life better for the people you're working with and for you? And there weren't good answers mm-hmm. to that.
And can I just dig in on?
Oh. Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to just, there's something very significant about the means and the ends, because it yeah. seems like your aspiration was coming from this pure place of, I want to help. I want to better the world. And yet the means in which you did it was adversarial. It was aggressive. And even though there's a part of you that liked it, it didn't quite go in alignment with that aspiration to make the world a better place. There was some sort of incongruency there that I think of as like the grain in the oyster, right? There's just something there that irritated you.
Yeah, it was more than irritating. I mean, there's something about it that felt kind of profoundly wrong. I mean, not always. You know, for Joseph Spell, it was profoundly right. And for some other cases, too. But far too many, it was felt like the gulf between people that was there at the beginning of a trial would actually increase with the determination that one was right and the other was wrong. And that just felt like a framework that didn't actually fit the reality as I understood it. And we were all kind of pretending, yes, this is the reality. Somebody was determined to be the winner. Somebody is determined to be the loser. And we all go on with our lives with that kind of mark. But what does that mean in terms of the relations between people? Didn't help.
And can we just talk about that for a second, Gary? Because so many people are, so many lawyers are attracted to your center's programming and teachings. And I think what you're talking about here is a big part of the reason why. Because you were talking about this role that you're required to take as a lawyer where you're a zealous advocate and that you felt uncomfortable stepping fully into that role all the time because while sometimes it serves the ends of justice, other times it creates its own reality. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you know, I mean, at first it was... And I don't want to say the adversary system is wrong. As a matter of fact, I think the adversary system for the people for whom the adversary system fits is terrific. Because it can, at best, level the playing field between people that are, you know, have disparate amounts of power, especially if you have, you know, a powerful lawyer representing somebody who's one down. This can actually make things better. So I don't want to turn this into just a critique of the adversary system is bad. That's not right. It didn't fit for me, and it didn't fit for a lot of the people that I was trying to help. And I was helpless once in the role to do anything about that. It wasn't, you know, so I would often find myself kind of struggling with, do I do this or do I not do this? Doing this will actually help my client, but it doesn't actually feel particularly right.
Yeah. And I want to talk more about that later. I think we will, because I've definitely heard you talk a lot about how important the lawyer's role is in a successful mediation process when people do come in with attorneys. But we got to the point where you were deciding that this wasn't the thing that you wanted to continue to do. So can you talk about what you did at that point?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my whole life, of course, was in turmoil with this decision. Mm-hmm. It was really like a tsunami to the family, the relationship with my father. And I also decided at that time to get a divorce. You know, with the leaving of the firm, I had also spent a year before I became a lawyer. I'd spent a year in California after I'd graduated from law school teaching in Southern California. And I had this idea of teaching high school kids about law, with the hope that that would actually be helpful, because that was in 69 and 70 was with the height of the fight against, you know, the Vietnam War. And so I worked with these kids in this very rich private school and put them together with kids from a high school who were all much lower rung in terms of money and class. And it was an incredible year for me to be able to spend this year teaching these kids and feeling like, and of course living in California at that time, the lights went on about a possible what life could be like for me personally. And also I was very excited about being able to be part of a transformation of these kids. As a matter of fact, of the kids that I was teaching in the high school, in the private school, a third of the class went on to become lawyers, which was really disproportionate. But it was so. Anyhow, I had that there in my background about how life could be, and so when I quit, it was, let's go back to California. That's where you experienced an expansiveness that was really kind of amazing. I did that. That was the first thought that I'd had. I'd been thinking when I left California, I will come back. I'll go practice law for a year and so, and then, because I felt obligated to do that. But I'm coming back because I felt like there was something there for me that had to do with a more expansive kind of life.
Yeah. Was that in the Bay Area?
No, that was in Southern California, in Hollywood. I lived on the beach, Venice Beach.
Wow.
A little shack on the beach.
And can you just tell us, what did you teach them about the law that made so many of them want to become lawyers?
Yeah, no, it was really, it was interesting, because the first, I was from the East Coast. I came in with a suit on, and all these kids looked at me. It was like I was obviously some jerk. My idea was to take my criminal procedure book from law school and teach, which was so alive with the people's stories, and teach that to these kids. And I had this idea of actually, they were in police cars, and I had a very strong political leaning. You know, that there were a lot of things that were really wrong with America, and so there was this, especially this underdog feeling, that was a really big deal. And so the kids had that feeling too. And of course, but what I didn't know when I it happened to me the first day of class, one of the students I was teaching this case that was actually involved rape, and one of the students said, "Well, why would there be any laws against rape?" And it was, think that through. Had I ever thought about that? Actually, not really. So I was challenged every bit of the way with these really smart kids. Mm-hmm. And I said I remember saying this at the end of the first class, well, whatever I had in mind for what I was going to be teaching you this year, I'm sure I was completely misguided. So the way this class is going to work, the only way it can work, is if we do this together, I think through a lot of things I haven't thought through. You're going to help me do that. And I hope you'll think through things that you haven't thought through. And so that was where the year came from, this spirit of real being together with these kids in 12th grade and 11th grade and 9th grade. And so it was very, very exciting for me.
Well, that sounds truly transformative, Gary, both for the kids and for you. Because yeah. I picture that learning in those days was very top-down, meaning you were the expert, you held the knowledge, and you would pour it on your students, and they would be vessels to receive. And it sounded like that's not at all what happened, that right. there was this collaborative feeling, there was a back and forth. And I don't know what inspired you, but it seemed like you stepped down from that pedestal and really asked them to consider collaborating with
you. Well, it was survival. actually, the school was very oriented in that way. So I remember the orientation that we got was there's a guy, a very famous Jungian psychologist named Harold Stone. And he did the orientation of the new teachers. And he started the orientation with playing us the song Suzanne by Leonard Cohen. And he said, "Do you want to understand these kids these days? Listen to this song." And he took, we spent about 3 or 4 hours picking that song apart. And it was just absolutely mind-blowing to me to actually engage at that level of understanding of what kids are going through and what life was about. And so, yes, it was, I had tremendous support for this rather revolutionary feeling that we all had.
So you were surrounded by like-minded people.
Yeah, so I mean, the best teachers I've ever seen in my life. You know, there was a woman teaching history who became a really close friend of mine, and she taught 17th century literature, and it was something about Christ, you know, and ain't easy was the title of the course, and she took all these kids back into the 17th century and brought that. So alive. So anyhow, I can go on, but probably you don't want me to.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, that's what Feng just said about the way that you taught, I think is really striking to me, because I was sitting here thinking about the fact that I think one thing that probably makes you a great mediator, certainly makes you a great teacher, is your ability and willingness to be led by, or at least be open to responding to the people in the room rather than feeling the need to control what's happening in the room. Do you think that's always been part of your makeup?
Interesting. No, I mean, my education was always, you know, as Fong says, top down, with very few glimpses of anything different than that. I think it was just kind of in me. And some of it was, I think, fair enough. You know, maybe a reaction to my father being rather authoritarian. That I never felt like that was a very productive way for people to talk to each other. I mean, we loved each other, and that was always true. But the conversations were always this kind of, you know, power-driven kind of conversations, and I felt like I didn't even when I was really little, I didn't know why. I just knew that it didn't feel very complete. It didn't feel full. The conversations, there was always seemed like there was more, and the right-wrong framework was so strong in all of those conversations, all of them. That it was like, that's the point. And it never seemed to me that it addressed the reality enough of what was going on.
Yeah.
I'm just, again, I think time and place is so important. I mean, you mentioned the Vietnam protests, and, you know, I'm just picturing a time where there were many like you who grew up in authoritarian or very kind of pedigreed sort of families finding an alternative. And during that time, people were having things like teach-ins, you know, having like each one teach one and sitting around in circles and, you know, doing psychedelics together. And there seems to be at that time this blossoming of people trying different ways and wanting to be in more egalitarian structures. So California sounds very significant in your journey because you met people who allowed those things to happen, that it wasn't just this feeling that life could be different, but you got to experience life being different.
Exactly. Yeah, no, that's right. And, you know, and it was music and just understanding life that comes from music. And it was a very fertile scene. I got to know some of these rather well-known people in the and of course there was marijuana, I'd never done that before, and of course it was every place, and it was also kind of out of control in some ways. Teachers sometimes came into class stoned. Students were living with teachers. I mean, it was really there were almost like no rules. So it was a time of incredible ferment. They closed the school down to protest the Vietnam War on a couple of days. And at the same time, there were people coming into the school so fertile and very challenging of people. Alex Haley was very close to some of the parents, and he was just writing Roots, and he came in and he spoke to the whole school about Roots, and it was, you know, it was like day after day. There were kind of incredible things that we were learning and understanding.
Wow. And who are some of those musical influences? You want to drop some names?
Yeah, well, of course, Joni Mitchell, and there was a place called McCabe's. It's still there, I think, in Los Angeles. We used to go there all the time, there were, you know, all of those people of the late 60s, Jackson Browne, Linda Ronstadt. There were actually the history teacher was her road manager. so there were, and it was pre Jerry Brown times. There were, you know, all of those, and they were, of course, they were hanging out with each other, and they were hanging out with us, and we with them, and it was just kind of amazing. And, you know, I'm not going to say it was all good. It was incredibly challenging and enormous for a kid from, you know, New England, growing up in a very kind of straight family, to have that be exposed to really different ideas was just amazing.
So when you realized that you wanted to break free then from where you'd grown up and the law firm that you could have spent your future in, probably a lucrative future, and also your marriage. It sounded like California, you'd had this experience there, and that was the natural place to return.
Well, of course, there was another piece of it, which was in 1972 or 3, I think, I met Trish, my wife, now my wife. And that was through Planned Parenthood, where I was chairman of the board of Planned Parenthood for some reason that had nothing to do with my knowing anything about what their work, but they wanted a young lawyer and mostly it was this older white women who wanted me to do that. And a lot of them were my mother's friends. But when we needed to have a director, and so Trish was one of the applicants, and I met her, and it was like, oh my goodness. my life was turned upside down. And she had these ideas that came, actually, one of them came from, she was connected to a guy named Danilo Dolci, who was an Italian who was actually trying to create a whole revolution in Italy in terms of more egalitarian relations. And she had a vision for what Planned Parenthood could be. And it meant that these older white women weren't the people, the best people to deal with inner city problems. We were in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and we needed people from the community that were actually the people that went to the clinics and the and organizers and political people. And so so together we created this task force. It was really her idea, but I thought it was terrific. And we both had a California background. She'd been going to college out here. And so we created this task force, and the task force was composed of all people that were really the people that really the communities. They were people of color. They were people of influence. They were people of credibility. They were people that understood what was happening in the community. And so the task force actually became the de facto board, because they would do the real work, and then we would bring the recommendations of the task force to the women on the board, and they would just rubber stamp it because they were just interested in being with each other and didn't really see Planned Parenthood as a kind of having a political anything. But the task force did. And so that's where, and that became actually a model that got used beyond our little local organization and went kind of statewide. And we had people that were really interested from what was called, which was HEW, Health Education Welfare. And they got very excited about what we were doing, bringing these people who had been kind of disenfranchised into decision-making a power to actually make these decisions about what would happen with Planned Parenthood and be more relevant.
Was HEW?
No, HEW was, I guess, it's the Department of Health now. I mean, so it was, but they were funding it. So anyhow, as we became, you know, more of a team and also fell in love, when I decided to quit, I decided I was moving to California. Shortly after I did that, then she did move to California. And that's where we began our life. We continued our life together, but we were a couple by then.
Thank you for listening to part one of episode one of the Other Chair podcast. If you, like us, have not yet had enough of this conversation with Gary Friedman, you are in luck. Listen to part two of episode one. Until next time, you can find us on our website, www.understandinginconflict.org. And you can also find us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. Take care.